In the fifth aliyah of Parshas Bahar, there is a pasuk that is very significant, or at least a pair of pasukim here, but that refer to our obligation to take care of those who are in need. So if you look at pasuk Lamed Hey, start from there, and lead into the next pasuk, it says, V'chi yomach achicha, u'mateh yado imach, v'hachzakta bo, ger v'soshav v'chayimach. So if your friend starts to falter, starts to have a problem supporting himself, so then you have to lift him up. You have to help him with that. And what does that mean? So that could mean a lot of things, but assuming that you are going to help him with a loan, let's say, so then the next pasuk, the next two pasukim, tell us that there is an important restriction on how you do that. And this is the prohibition of taking interest, what we call ribbis today. But ribbis is rabbinic language. The Torah uses slightly different language, and actually two different words in these next two psukim. Al tikach meito neshech v'sarbis v'yareisa me'elokecha v'chei achich imach. And also in the following pasuk, es kaspucha lo sitein lo b'neshech v'v'marbis lo sitein ochlecha. So here the prohibition of taking interest is a interesting topic and really a fascinating topic, and one that is both understandable and not so understandable, and is intuitive and non-intuitive, because there are aspects of it that we can relate to and can connect to on an intuitive way, and aspects that are much more surprising. And it's one that has been held on to also by other religions. Islam in particular has a very strict prohibition of interest. Christianity historically had a prohibition on interest, where the Jews ended up being the moneylenders. And when it comes to the Torah, so here we have a very strict prohibition of interest as well. And we also find that it is so chomer, it's mentioned several times in the Torah, also in Parshas Mishpatim and also in Parshas Kisetze. And that Chazal added on many layers of severity to it. So there are many Isurim Derabanan. But also, just on a level, Min HaTorah, so there's a lot that needs to be understood. So intuitively, there's a certain degree to which we can understand it, that if the idea is that you're exploiting somebody who's in need, somebody who is having a bad situation financially and can't pay their rent and can't pay their bills, and they come to you and they say, please help me out. And you say, yeah, sure, I'll help you if you pay me for it. And then they're not able to do that because they were in a bad situation to begin with. So it keeps getting worse and worse for them. And they're further and further in a hole. And then you keep adding on because they're not paying. So then ultimately you own them because you're pushing them further and further into a state of disadvantage. So then it's easy to understand what the issue is. And there are laws against that. That's called predatory lending. It's called usury. Once upon a time, the word usury was used to mean interest as a whole. Nowadays, if you look that up in the dictionary, that's called archaic usage. And in contemporary usage, usury means that kind of exploitative interest. It was called predatory lending. So if that's what it's about, that you're taking advantage of somebody in need and pushing them further into problems, then we can understand it. And to a certain extent, that is here. And the language of neshech has that connotation. So neshech literally means to bite. And if you look in the Sefer Achinuch, that is how he understands it. So that would be okay if that was the whole story. But there are many aspects of the prohibition of ribbis that don't fit that model as well and that require greater explanation. And we also have another word here, tarbis, which is closer to the contemporary word of ribbis, tarbis and ribbis, and that doesn't automatically have the same connotation of a bite, but just means any increase, and reflects the fact that we have a very chomer prohibition, even though you see Rashi over here quotes the Gemara in Bav Metzia, that chad shavin rabbanan, that this double language, we see this as one iser, v'lavor lav b'shnei lavin, but it's two phrased with two, to have two prohibitions attached to it, but it really also highlights that there's different elements here. On the one hand, yes, there is this aspect of hurting somebody by exploiting their problems, but there seems to be other aspects to it as well. And just to highlight some of what doesn't necessarily fit that model of taking advantage of the person who can't pay his bills, we find, first of all, that it applies to any amount. And certainly that's at odds with contemporary financing, because there should be, you would imagine, some amount of interest which is reasonable and conventional. And yet, that's certainly not the case here on a level of Min HaTorah, that any increase at all is included in this Isser. And we find by rabbinic law, it's piled on much more. So that itself is very noteworthy. In addition, this is especially surprising, that if this is about victimizing the person in need, so you would think that the bad guy here would be the lender who is taking this interest and forcing this interest. And yet, we find that the halacha considers the borrower to be an equal offender here, that the isser applies just as much to the borrower as it does to the lender. So that certainly would seem to be very surprising. It's literally blaming the victim in this model. And that's something that needs to be explained. And also, what would seem to go together with that, but is also otherwise surprising, if we're dealing here with a victimization, so if the person who's supposed to be the victim is okay with it, then that wouldn't be victimizing. But yet, we find when it comes to ribbis that the borrower is not allowed to be mochel. He's not allowed to say, I'm happy to pay the interest, I'm willing to do this, which is easily imaginable. You can certainly conceive a person saying, I'm happy to pay, and yet the halacha doesn't allow that. This isn't something that's given to mechil at all, which is very much at contrast with normal rules of ben adam l'chavero. Hi.
Why can't we say that even if that victim is okay with paying the interest, it enables the loan giver to charge interest from others?
It might be. That might be one way of explaining it. We'll see. But it's still part of a pattern of some details here that all together require some greater explanation. So far, that's the third detail that's a little surprising. What's also interesting is that if this is something that is a basic moral offense, so you would expect that this would apply across the board like other moral offenses. And yet the Torah is very explicit here, maybe more so elsewhere, that this isser only applies between Jews and doesn't apply when dealing with non-Jews. There were views in Rishonim that weren't accepted, that took it in either direction. The view of the Rambam was that you're obligated to charge interest when lending money to a non-Jew. That wasn't accepted the halacha. There was also a view that there's an issur d'rabbanan to charge interest to non-Jews. L'maisa, nowadays we treat this as a neutral point, that there's no prohibition to charge interest to non-Jews, there's no mitzvah to charge interest to non-Jews, but it's clear that this issur only applies between Jews. So that itself is also very striking if this really is a overall moral principle. And we'll add one fifth detail that's perhaps also not so easily understood in light of the victimization model, that, as we noted, there are many Torah prohibitions and there are many more rabbinic prohibitions. So very often, a case of interest may only be a violation on the level of midrabanan. So the main factor that determines whether it's daraisa or not is perhaps surprising if we're focusing on the fact that you are taking from somebody something they can't afford, because the main detail that tells you whether it's daraisa or not is whether it was set that way to begin with, which is called ribbis kitzutza. And that's why the phrase ribbis kitzutza is actually interchangeable or synonymous with ribbis daraisa. It's the same idea. It's the same usage. So that is pretty surprising, because you would think the focus is on the taking of the money, regardless of whether it was set up that way. And what's very counterintuitive is if I don't set up the deal to begin with interest, and I do take it in the end, that would be an issur d'rabbanan. But if I set up the deal to begin with, insisting on interest, and I don't take the interest in the end, that would be an issur d'oraisa. So the idea that it's worse to make the deal under terms of interest that I don't end up collecting than it is to collect interest without having stipulated that to begin with is very counterintuitive also. So all of these details require explanation, and I'll mention four theories of Ribbis. I don't know if any one of them explains all of it together, but if you take all of the four together, so then they would seem to answer up all of these problems. So part of the question that's required to ask in understanding what the Isser is about is also to be aware, the Achronim posed the question, is Ribbis really what it looks like, which is a Avera ben Adam l'chavero in the realm of Mamonos? Or is it something else, despite what it looks like? And is it really an Avera ben Adam l'makom in the realm of, say, Yoridea? And despite the fact that it involves people and money, it's not really a ben Adam l'chavero Mamonos concept. And one clue that it might be a Yoridea kind of concept is, if you want to look it up in Shulchan Aruch, you'll find it in Yoridea. So the Tur explains why he put it in Yoridea, but one way or another, that's noteworthy that it's not there in Choshen Mishpat with all the other monetary rules, but it's in Yoridea, which certainly seems very out of place. So that lends some support to the idea that this is actually, despite its appearances, something that is a aspect of a ben adam l'makom concept and not subject to the normal monetary rules. So just to keep that in mind as we go through some of the possible explanations. So one way to understand what's going on here, if you look in the Tshuvas Avnei Nezer, the Sachet Shavu Rebbe, in his Tshuvas, part of his section on Ribbis, he has a separate title for, and he calls it Kuntras Bris Achim. So why does he call it that? So yes, Bris is an anagram of Ribbis, that's cute, but also Bris Achim is an idea based on what's found in the Rishonim that Ribbis represents a covenant among brothers, that it may be reasonable to charge a certain normal rate of interest that's not excessive, but the assumption is you wouldn't do that to your brother. So if a stranger comes to you and says, I need a loan, okay, to charge a normal, reasonable rate of interest is acceptable. But to your own brother, to somebody very close to you, you wouldn't do even that. And apparently the idea of Ribbis is meant to underscore specifically the family relationship between Jews, and that's the idea. So it's a covenantal message. And if that's the point, so then we could say that it is an Avera ben Adam l'chavero, but it's different than other ben Adam l'chaveros. Normally, or often, we use ben Adam l'chavero and morality kind of interchangeably, that we assume that all of the ben Adam l'chaveros, like stealing and killing, are general principles of morality. And perhaps this is a different category, that it is ben adam l'chavero, but it's not something that's basic to human morality. It's above that. It's more than basic morality, and it reveals a higher level of expectation, more of a familial connection. And that could explain some of the details, especially the focus specifically on the Jewish people. So in that perspective, it would be a ben adam l'chavero, but a different kind of ben adam l'chavero. Alternatively, if you want to say that it really is a ben adam l'makom, and that could explain some of the details, such as the fact that the borrower is part of the avera, and that the borrower is not allowed to be mochel, so that would work if we understand this to be a ben adam l'chavero, a ben adam l'makom rather. So why should it be? What's ben adam l'makom about this? So perhaps we can understand this by looking a little bit at the context of the rest of the Parsha and drawing a comparison. So we also find in the Parsha Shemitah. You know, Shemitah is often held up as a symbol of Emunah. And we can understand how that flows, that if you're going to take a year off of working the land and still trust that you'll survive, so that's an expression of faith. But imagine if somebody were to say that, okay, Rabbi, I'll follow your instructions and I won't work the land, but I'll only do this if you sign me a contract in writing that if I fall short of anything this year, you will supplement my losses. You'll compensate me for anything that I don't make. So that may also technically be acceptable, But it's not going to be too much of a declaration of faith. So perhaps there's a similar idea here that we have a mandate of chesed. And it may not be fully appreciated, but the mitzvah of halva, which is also related here in this idea of the previous pasuk of a hechazakta bo, that you have to help out somebody who is faltering financially. The mitzvah of lending money is one of the paradigmatic concepts of chesed that we find in the Torah. So essentially, this represents the whole notion of chesed. And in the Sefer Avos Chesed of the Chafetz Chaim, about half of it is about lending money. It's a tremendous amount of attention to that chesed specifically. Even if it's not necessarily the first example you'd come up with if I asked you to list chesedim, but we find that it is held up both in Shas and elsewhere as one of the first examples. So perhaps the message here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, I want you to engage in chesed. And if our response is, okay, so you want chesed, I'll do that, but I need a contract. I need it to be written and stipulated in advance that I'll be covered the same way as I'd be covered if I left the money in the bank. I'm not asking for anything exorbitant, just the same interest rate that I'd get in the bank, I want to be covered the same way in writing. Otherwise, I'm not getting involved. So if you make such a stipulation, that's not necessarily an offense against the borrower, because maybe it's very reasonable and you're helping him out, but it's an offense against the Kadosh Baruch Hu, who said that I want you to do chesed and trust me that it's going to work out for you. And you say that I'm only going to do it if I get the same deal as I would in the bank. So that is an offense against him. And therefore, it's more of a ben adam lamakom. So that could explain, again, why the borrower is not able to be mochel and why he's a part of the Avera. But also that unusual idea that the nature of the Avera is defined specifically by the moment of stipulation, by the Ketsutza, by saying that this is the terms under which I am going to give the loan and otherwise not. But if you take interest later, even though you would have thought that's worse because you're actually then hurting the person by taking this money, but that's apparently a lower level problem. It's a problem, but it's a problem with Rabbanan for sure. But it's not the Iker Isser here because that's not necessarily what it's all about, which is otherwise a surprising point. A third way we could explain it, which may also address some of these issues, is perhaps what's going on here is if, again, we focus on the idea of halva as a core chesed and something which is similar, very much so, to the act of tzedaka. So just as tzedaka, we're supposed to look at it as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving us money to disperse, and there are rules, there are priorities to how you give out tzedaka. So too, when it comes to halva, presumably we also have the same mindset that we have money to disperse, and we're supposed to do so with some level of objectivity. There's discretion also, but some level of objectivity. Now imagine, as a comparison, if you were in charge of a fund, a public loan fund, that people had contributed to a fund to be used for public loans, a gemach, and you were in charge of deciding who gets to borrow from that fund, and you accepted payments from people who applied for loans. That would seem to be the height of corruption. That would be scandalous. So plug that into here. So if you're supposed to have some kind of objectivity in giving out your loans, and people who are asking to borrow can pay interest, that amounts essentially to the people who are asking to say, I'm willing to pay this rate in order to get it, and I'll pay more than the other guy. So you'll be induced to give to that person rather than somebody else who might be more deserving or higher up on the list of priorities. So essentially, this amounts to a type of bribery, a type of shochad. And perhaps that's the nature of the Isser. So that is an interesting perspective that could also explain a number of things. But if we see this as shochad, so then it would explain very well why the borrower is part of the Avera, because he's not the victim at all. The victim is the other guy who doesn't get the loan. So certainly it's not something that's going to let the borrower off the hook. And we can understand very well why the borrower can't be mochel, because again, he's not the victim at all. He's the one giving the bribe. and therefore there's no reason to allow him to be mochel. Also, we could understand another din, which may be deraisa, maybe derabanan, depends on how you understand it. But there's also a concept of ribbis dvarim, that ribbis applies not only if the borrower pays you money or things of value, but even if he just treats you nicely in a way that he wouldn't otherwise have done. So for it to be deraisa, if it can be, it would have to be ksutza, meaning that the person would say, okay, lend me money and I'll treat you nicely, I'll say hello to you in the hall, which sounds very high school, but perhaps that's what we're talking about. But nonetheless, it's hard to understand why, if we're talking about exploitation, why that should be an issue, because this doesn't cost anything to the borrower, so it only benefits the lender. Why should that be so terrible? So from that perspective, yes, it's a good question, but if we're looking at it from the perspective of shochad, shochad is more about benefiting the other person than it is about what it costs the person giving. And perhaps then that's the issue. And just like when it comes to shochad, there is a concept of shochad dvarim, of bribing a judge with nice treatment and not just with money. So too, there's a parallel concept, perhaps, of ribbis dvarim, and it could fit into that idea. And a fourth way to understand it is, I think it's maybe what you're alluding to, that essentially maybe it is what it looks like, that maybe it is about exploitation of the borrower. So then we have to explain, so why does it apply at any rate, and why don't we allow mechila? So maybe it applies at any rate just because there's no way to draw the line at what is exploitative and what isn't, and we have to just have an across-the-board policy. And the question of why there's no mechila is because if we would allow mechila, then the whole protection would fall apart, that everyone would have to be mocho, that if we say that this is meant to allow people to get free loans, but if you're willing to waive that right, then you can, then everyone's going to be pressured to waive the right, and nobody is going to be in a position to get this benefit. So therefore, the whole concept would fall apart. So perhaps that's why you have to have those rules also, and perhaps that could make sense. Of course, much more to say about this, but just to try to address the other crucial three words in this pasuk, which have tremendous implications. So the pasuk ends with the words v'chei achicha imach, which are earth-shattering on a lot of levels. So just first of all, so it's implications for ribbis. So there is a machlokas in the Gemara about this, but we assume that v'chei achicha imach comes to tell us regarding ribbis another halacha about that, that there is an obligation to return the ribbis. So if somebody charged ribbis and collected it, so then he's obligated to give it back. And that, we assume, applies only to ribbis d'araisa and not to ribbis d'rabanan, in the sense that ribbis d'araisa, ribbis k'tzutza, yotzei b'dayanim, meaning that you can go to a bezdin, and the bezdin will compel the person who took ribbis to return it. When it comes to rabbinic ribbis, there's different categories. Some of it, there's a notion, latzei slidei shamayim, to give it back, that it's morally right to give it back. And some of it is less than that, that isn't even really anything to give back. But in none of those cases would Beis Din get involved. But when it's daraisa, so then because this pasuk v'chei achicha imach, so there is an obligation to return ribbis. So there is a major discussion as to whether that is part of the issur of ribbis and a consequence of it, or maybe it's really a separate concept that essentially the money is illegitimately in your possession, and therefore you have to return money that's not yours. And it reflects the fact that ribbis, as we see already, is somewhat unusual and an outlier. And some of the achronim related to ribbis in a very unusual way. It said that ribbis is not like other monetary violations, because on some level it's both legitimate and illegitimate, because it can be legitimate because it's an agreement between two consenting adults, and yet the Torah prohibited it anyway. So some phrase it, ribbis chovhi v'hatara asrasa, that it's a debt that actually makes sense, but still the Torah prohibited it anyway, and that could have various consequences. The Chazon Ish was opposed to that notion. He said it's possible for something that's prohibited in the Torah to be legitimate, but there are various implications of what that would mean. So it's on some level a chiddush to say that you have to return it, given that there could be some basis to say that it was paid legitimately. So here there was a major machlokes between the Rambam and the Gaonim, that even though we say the borrower is not able to be mochel, but what about at this level? So what about if already we're two steps beyond what should have happened, that the lender charged ribbis, which he shouldn't have done, and he collected the ribbis, which he shouldn't have done, but now he's at the third stage where he's obligated to return it, so he's ready to give it back, and the borrower says, it's okay, I'm mochel, I don't need to take it back. So can he be mochel on that and refuse to take it back? So that was a machlokes. The Gaonim said, no, there's no mechila by ribbis. He can't be mochel. He has to accept it back. And the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch followed the Rambam, said that, there you can be mochel. There he can accept this idea and he doesn't have to take it back. And Shulchan Aruch passing like that, the Taz went so far as to say that if he doesn't say anything, so then you can assume mechila. Others thought that was too much. He has to actually explicitly be mochel, but he can be mochel and decline to take it back. So if you say that, so why is it different? If you're not allowed to pay ribbis in the first place, why are you allowed to decline to take it back? So one way to explain it is based on the last explanation we just said, that it could be that really the reason you can't agree to pay ribbis is because that would make the whole system fall apart, because everyone would be pressured to pay ribbis, otherwise they won't get the loan. But at this point, there's no pressure. You've already got your loan, you've already paid it back, and it's just a question of whether you're going to accept a repayment of what you paid. So what's the pressure not to take it at that point? So we have no reason to assume that's insincere or that that would make the whole system fall apart. So that could be a actual mechila, so maybe that's why the Rambam allows it. But another way to understand it, as some Achronim point out, Reb Baruch Meir Leibowitz and others, the author of the Birka Shmuel, as a Talmud, Diane Grossness from London, is Chuvis, where he talks about this in the name of his Rebbe, Reb Baruch Meir, that it could be that there's two different dinim in this pasuk, that the din of not charging ribbis, so that is a din bein adam lamakom. So that is about the charging initially, and that there's no mechila for, because it's bein adam lamakom, so it's not up to the borrower to say he's okay with it. But that avera takes place at the beginning when you charge ribbis. So once that happens, there's no way to fix that other than tshuva, because the avera is in the charging it to begin with. So you can do tshuva for that, but you can't otherwise fix it, because returning it is not going to undo the fact that you insisted on the ribbis at the beginning, which was, for example, that lack of emunah that we mentioned before. But you still have to give it back, because here you have money illegitimately, and the pasuk says, v'cheyachich imach, you have to return it. So it could be that that returning it, that's a different din. That's ben adam l'chavero. So that ben adam l'chavero, like all the other ben adam l'chaveros, the individual has the right to be mochel, and perhaps that's what's going on. You're allowed to be mochel on giving it back. So that you're allowed to... No, because the iser to charge it in the first place and to accept it, accept the payment, that's bein adam l'makom. But no, once you've already...
If it's the rabbanan, meaning you didn't charge it, and then the guy wants to give you an extra dollar.
No, so that's ribbis, paying ribbis drabbanan. But here we're talking about after you've already taken ribbis, and there's a mitzvah to give it back, to repay it to the borrower. So that might be an avera bein adam l'chavero, or mitzvah bin adam l'chavero, rather. So that he could be mochel on. That he could say, all right, now that I've already violated the iser, the two of us have already violated the iser of paying ribbis, I can decline taking it back, because that's a different thing. And that's a bin adam l'chavero. So that's as far as some points about ribbis. But just to quickly note that there are other major, major implications that are connected to v'cheyachicha imach that are not about ribbis, but are about even greater life and death issues. And there is a often cited Gemara with tremendous implications, even though the understandings are quite complex, that the Gemara also in Ezun Eshech and the Gemara in Daf Samach Beis Amud Aleph in Bav Metzia has a machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Pitur about the following situation, that if there were two people who were traveling in a desert and they were endangered because they're in this desert without water, and one of them has a jug of water and the other doesn't. So Rabbi Akiva held that the one who has the water is allowed to drink it, despite the fact that that means the other one is going to die. And Ben Patur was of a different opinion, that he held that he's not allowed to drink it, and that you can't save yourself at the expense and of the other, and they should both die, and neither should see the other one die at his own expense, at that person's expense. And Rabbi Akiva disagreed, and he referred to this pasuk, that your life takes precedence. And this is, of course, especially striking because Rabbi Akiva is so firmly associated with V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. But we understand then all the more so that together with the principle of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha is this idea of V'chayach yicha imach, that chayacha kodmim, that your life has to come first. And as the Rush explains in his commentary to Bava Tzvi and others explain, that the way he's reading that here is that imach is means something secondary to you, as we mentioned the other day, comparable to S, then it means something secondary to you, so that, yes, your brother should live with you, but on a secondary level to you, so you have to worry about your life first, and then also worry that he should live with you. So if it means that you're going to have to die in order to make him live, so then that's not what we mean. So it is a major discussion as to what the implications of this Gemara are and what Ben Patur's opinion is, because presumably Ben Patur is not coming from nowhere. So what exactly is the nature of this machlokas? It's a very extensive literature, just to note some of the points. So Reb Chaim in the Hilchos Yesod HaTorah understood that you see from here that we know that murder is Yehariv Vayavor, that you're not allowed to save your own life by killing someone else. And you maybe would have thought that that's only active murder, but that passive murder, that standing by and letting somebody else die when you save your own life, which would seem to be only a violation of Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, which we read in Parshas Kedoshim. So you see here that theoretically that also could have been Yehariv Vayavor, that you're not even allowed to passively save your life if that means someone else is going to die at that cost. And that could have been the din, except that the pasuk here explicitly tells you that no, that you're allowed and you should keep your own life protected, even if that means that you're passing up an opportunity to save somebody's own life, to save somebody else's life. Of course, the point is that the one who's doing this is already got the water, so he's not stealing the water from the other guy. The water is in his own hands, and he is passing up the opportunity to share it with somebody else. So it's a passive violation of Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, but apparently that also could have been Yehariv Vayavor, were it not from the pasuk. And the Menachas Chinuch in Reish Sadi Vav notes that Ben Patur, who argues, so he basically understands that this obligation applies to both of them, so each of them is in the position to essentially have to be Moser Nefesh as a Yehariv Vayavor rather than save their own life at the expense of the other, as a reflection of this principle. And he adds, therefore, if one was a baby who doesn't have a chiyuv and mitzvos, so then the adult would be obligated to save the baby's life at the expense of his own life, because he would have this mandate and the child would not. But it's noteworthy that in the Taras Konim here in Bahar, so the machlokus is presented differently, and there's a different nature of the drasha, that they both point to the pasuk. So in the Gemara, it's Rabbi Akiva who darshans the pasuk and Ben Patur who doesn't. But in the Taras Konim, Ben Patur has a different understanding of the pasuk, and he understands it as imach, he should be with you, so therefore both of you have to drink together. But that means that neither of you will have enough to survive, and Rabbi Akiva understands that the owner has to drink all of it. So the nature of the machlokus there seems to be, as it's presented in the Taras Konim, that it's a question of measuring chayi olam versus chayi shah. That's a term that you find a few places in Shas, that how do you evaluate two lives against each other, or sometimes it's used in a different context, that chayi olam means not literally eternal life, but saving somebody's life in a lasting, significant way, that they can then proceed to live a normal lifespan, versus Chayisha, which is a temporary salvation, but then will soon restore them back to their initial state of danger. So if you have to choose that the owner of the water can save himself in a way that will be lasting, Chayolam, and then he'll be able to emerge from this crisis, and otherwise, Ben Patur's position would be that they'll share, and they'll both live a little bit longer, but neither of them will be saved from this crisis. So it's a Chayisha. So according to Ben Patur, the Chayisha of the two of them is preferable to the Chayolam of the owner. And the Netziv, in his commentary to the Sheiltas, adds that perhaps Ben Patur is also throwing in the factor here that maybe through this Chayisha, there's also the hope that they'll make it far enough to the Yishuv, that they'll get to civilization, and then they'll both be saved long-term. And then Rabbi Akiva's position is that you don't have to factor in that possibility, that the owner is entitled to rely on his possession of the water and save his own life in a more definite sense. So that also brings up the question of whether this notion of Chayei Kodmim, Chayecha Kodmim, is that a rishus, that you have the right to prioritize your own life, or is that an obligation? So let's say, for example, if the person who has the water is weaker than the person who doesn't have the water, so he knows that if he gives the water to the other guy, he'll have a better chance than he would have himself, or he has some other reason for deciding to give the water to the other guy. Should he have the right to do that? So a number of poskim considered this question, and Rav Cook, in his Shuvah's Mishpat Kohen, has a discussion about this, and he considers both sides of the issue. Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was the author of the Sridi Eish, wrote somewhere else that he thought that there was a nobility to that, that a person who chose to do that would be considered a kadosh. And Rav Unterman, who was also the chief rabbi of Israel after Rav Cook, so a few after Rav Cook, so he wrote that there isn't a right to do that because a person isn't the bialim on his own body, so therefore if we're told that he has the right to preserve his life, it means he has the obligation to preserve his life, and he's not entitled to do that. So it's a major discussion how this applies in other situations, and the Radbaz has a tshuva about whether one is permitted or obligated to give up a limb to save somebody else's life, where exactly that fits into this equation, and when one would enter into a risk when somebody else is definitely endangered, and to save that person, you would risk your own life, but not to the same degree of danger that they have, is widely understood to be a machlokas, the Bavli and the Rishalmi. So there's a very extensive literature that emerges from this passage that all surrounds this pasuk. There's also a major discussion that Shuvah Chaim Sofer and Rav Moshe Feinstein about the assumption that this should also apply to spiritual priorities as well, and that it's not only when it comes to material survival, physical survival, but also spiritual priorities. Should you also assume Chayecha Kodmim, or is there reason to assume that the schus of the mitzvah will have a different kind of impact? So that was a extensive discussion as well. So the impact of this pasuk on everything that we do in terms of our spiritual responsibilities towards others, in terms of our responsibility for the physical well-being towards others, is very significant. And the position of Ben Patur, which did not prevail, and Ben Patur himself did not prevail. My father is going to point out that Rabbi Akiva was such a dominant figure in the Gemara, and Ben Patur is not heard from anywhere else. So that's also a part of the implication of what may be a nobility to his attitude, but Lamaisa, if we're not going to survive by taking that perspective, so then we're not going to be able to help anyone else either. So Rabbi Akiva's pragmatism is also a crucial point here, that we need to do as much as we can to save and to rescue, and that mandate is very crucial, and yet to recognize that the language of this pasuk is also telling us that to maintain our own survival is a crucial part of being able to do that both today and in the future. Okay.